Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Just when you thought all the bank bailouts were done, Citigroup hauls in another government handout. In the Senate, well, it's healthcare, what else? And from Copenhagen, staying warm and saving energy in those cold Danish winters. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Bank of America, working to meet the capital needs of qualified businesses and consumers. Learn more at bankofamerica.com/ahead. And by Gather.com, the social network where people can make new friends who share their interests. People talking about today's news at news.gather.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. It is Wednesday, the 16th of December today. Glad to have you with us. Citigroup's and all the other banks benefiting from taxpayer largesse are indeed getting another Benny from Uncle Sam as part of their deals to repay the balance of their TARP money. The Internal Revenue Service has interpreted the tax code, one might say, in the bank's favor, to the tune of billions of dollars. Sounds egregious, but Marketplace's John Dimsdale reports now from Washington that it actually makes some sense.
Tax law lets companies deduct losses suffered one year from profits earned in future years. But that break isn't allowed to companies that are sold to new owners. The government's takeover of banks like Citigroup qualifies as a change in ownership. But the IRS says banks can go ahead and deduct their losses from future profits anyway. And now that the government is selling its stake in banks, the IRS says the tax deduction will be extended again. Cornell Management School professor Robert H. Frank says without the IRS ruling, Citigroup and other banks that accepted bailout money known as TARP would have to pay higher taxes on the profits they'll earn when the financial crisis is over.
If that were the case, then Citigroup wouldn't be able to raise the money to pay back the TARP loans that it took last year. So yes, it's a break for them, but I think in this case, it's one that serves the public interest as well.
The government will lose revenue from the tax breaks, although the exact amount depends on the bank's future performance. Conceivably, the IRS ruling is worth several billion dollars to banks that accepted TARP funds. But Sheldon Cohen, a former IRS commissioner, now with money manager Farr Miller, says the lost revenue is worth it.
The bank stock would have fallen. People would have lost confidence in the banks and maybe the monetary system. The whole cycle would have fed on itself.
The government owns about $25 billion worth of Citigroup stock as a result of the bailout. So a drop in the stock price would also hurt taxpayers, says Cohen, more than offsetting any revenue gain from higher taxes. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
I don't know what 3% of $25 billion worth of Citigroup stock is exactly, as John was mentioning, but that's how much Citigroup shares fell today, 3.09%, if you're the type who likes to keep track. You know, in a lot of places, kids take school buses to get to school. In New York City, they get free rides on the subway or city buses instead. Today, the city's public transportation system approved huge budget cuts, though, including getting rid of those free rides. The decision has caused something of an uproar, which, as Marketplace's Elisa Roth tells us, might have been precisely the point.
Every day, more than 500,000 students ride the subways and buses in New York City for free. The Metropolitan Transportation Authority, or MTA, says it could save $170 million a year by making those kids pay. It also wants to cut service and eliminate subway lines to balance its budget. Emily Gold runs an after-school program at a public defender's office in Harlem. She says if the budget cuts pass, a lot of families wouldn't be able to send their kids to school or to after-school programs like hers.
Probably there will be increased turnstile jumping. You know, that's misdemeanor crimes that kids can get charged with, let alone truancy issues.
But a lot of people say the MTA is just playing a big game of chicken. Robert Passwell is the interim president of City College in New York. He's also an expert in public transportation. He says the MTA is trying to make the city and state fork over more money.
They're saying, we're in big trouble here. You haven't lived up to your responsibility, state and city, and unless you do, we're all going to suffer for it. The long-run impact of transit cuts is not just that it's going to hurt children, but it's going to really hurt the overall economy of the city.
Before that happens, though, New Yorkers will have a chance to comment at a series of public hearings on the budget. Then the MTA's board will vote again to enact the cuts. Passwell guesses in the end the MTA won't make the students pay. He's seen situations like this play out before. When he ran Chicago's public transit system years ago, he always threatened to cut the most popular subway lines first. In New York, I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
If your travel plans this holiday season include London, England, things could get interesting for you. Pilots and flight attendants at British Airways have approved a strike starting this coming Tuesday. Today, baggage handlers and check-in staff at two major airports in Britain said they would stop work as well, as Christopher Worth reports.
The strike could cost British Airways some $50 million a day. Staff voted 9-1 in favor of a walkout. BA has asked Britain's High Court to intervene. It says the ballot unlawfully included votes from staff who'd already accepted voluntary buyouts. At issue are BA's plans to freeze pay next year, cut the size of some cabin crews, and switch 3,000 staff to part-time work. The airline lost $500 million in the first half of this year and pays its crews roughly double the going rate at its rival, Virgin. The carrier is still negotiating with the unions. If talks fail, the strike could affect more than 1 million travelers over the holiday period. In London, I'm Christopher Worth. For Marketplace.
Back here, inflation's up, but not too much. Housing starts are up, also not too much. Thus, the major indices wound up right where they started. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. We are 10 days and counting now into the UN Climate Conference, and not, it appears, any closer to a binding agreement than we were when the meeting started. There were huge street protests in the Danish capital today, and negotiations are barely crawling along. We've got Stephen Beard on the line from Copenhagen. Hello, Stephen.
Hello, Kai.
The mood, at least as portrayed in reports over here today, Stephen, was somewhat chaotic in Copenhagen, right?
Yes, both inside and outside the summit center. Outside, there was a big protest, mainly by environmental and other activists who were not being allowed into the summit center. They'd registered, many of them had been given summit badges, but they were turned away at the door in their thousands because of overcrowding. And it's emerged that, and this is one of the many mysteries about this summit, the Danes registered 45,000 people to come into this conference center, which under its fire regulations is only allowed to take 15,000. So they accredited three times more people than the structure can hold. They were handing out badges to virtually anyone with a vague interest in climate change. There's even a delegation here from the London Zoo.
Other than their organizational skills, Stephen, what are the substantive hang-ups at the conference?
Well, it's a deadlock once again over the main issues: carbon emission cuts, financial aid for the developing world, and compliance and verification. And it's pretty clear that there are these problems. I mean, this is frankly a very difficult conference and summit to follow. It's difficult to know exactly what's going on. But when you see the draft texts that are handed out every morning, there are lots of blank spaces, lots of brackets with nothing inside them. So it's clear that there is still major differences, and particularly differences between the US and China, the two key players at this summit.
It seems as if there is surprise that things have broken down. And I'm curious as to why, because when President Obama went to Asia 6 weeks ago, Copenhagen was, in essence, officially declared dead. And yet now people are shocked that it's not working out.
It is, once again, the triumph of hope over experience. People are hoping that they'll get a bandwagon going here, and they'll get enough momentum, enough countries signing up to the idea of tackling climate change, that in the end they'll get an agreement. Clearly they're not going to get a legally binding agreement this time. They're not going to get a treaty in Copenhagen, but what they're hoping for is a ringing political declaration that will then move this whole caravan, not to say circus, onto the next summit, perhaps in 6 months or a year's time.
Quickly, Stephen, President Obama shows up in the next day or so. I imagine a lot is riding on his arrival, yes?
Absolutely. He is the big hope. And many people are saying he wouldn't be coming unless he was absolutely certain of a deal. He's going to pull a rabbit out of the hat at the last minute. He's going to offer something that's going to clinch a deal. On the other hand, there are a lot of skeptics saying that China and other big players are not going to commit themselves until the Congress has spoken, until the U.S. Senate has passed a climate bill and the U.S. is fully committed. So there is a suspicion that what we're going to wind up with here is a rather bland climate pact, a lukewarm climate agreement.
Marketplace's Stephen Beard at the UN Climate Conference in Copenhagen, Denmark. Thank you, Stephen.
Okay, Kai.
China and the United States are far and away the world's largest emitters of greenhouse gases. Beijing is first. The United States is a close second. As Stephen just told us, there are big disagreements between the two sides about how much carbon each country ought to cut and who exactly is going to pay to make that happen. Washington suggests the booming Chinese economy doesn't need any financial help. China says, oh, no, it needs the money. Marketplace's Scott Tong has the view from Shanghai.
Young professionals grab lunch in downtown Shanghai. The restaurant's in a fancy high-rise. But HR manager Grace Lai says the idea that China is rich is a misconception.
China is economically big, but it's not economically strong. Say America and China both have cake. America cuts it into two pieces, and China cuts it into 10.
China has a billion mouths to feed, so no one here swallows the U.S. notion that China can pay for its own carbon reduction costs. And finance manager Huang Lan is unimpressed with the White House's stated goal of cutting U.S. emissions by 17%.
The American or the European Union, they're like saying big words, but what they have committed, I didn't see there is any real stuff in there.
For its part, China has pledged to cut what it calls carbon intensity by 40%. That would still allow emissions to rise. But many here feel that even this proposal would hurt China's economy. Meanwhile, in Copenhagen, the time left for a deal ticks away. Andrew Hupert teaches negotiation at NYU's Shanghai campus. He says Chinese bargainers are happy to stretch these talks out.
The Chinese side still feels there's a potential for advantage because it's gaining information and it's waiting for the situation to change. Whereas the American feels he's paying an opportunity cost by not taking action right away.
Hupert thinks Beijing is asserting itself at Copenhagen, showing that it's no longer the weak victim of 19th century colonial aggression.
This is definitely something that still is prevalent in the Chinese psyche, that they are coming back into their own after having a humiliating situation imposed on them by outsiders.
For all Beijing's rhetoric, many think it wants a deal. Alex Wong at the Natural Resources Defense Council says the fiery tone at Copenhagen is cooling on all sides.
People came out of their corners swinging. They established their positions firmly. What really matters is what happens this week. There's a lot of bargaining going on behind closed doors.
One Chinese government advisor says the West is pressing China on many issues, from protectionism to human rights. The issue Beijing can deliver on most easily is climate change. In Shanghai, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Coming up, energy taxes in Denmark are sky high, but the complaints are few.
All people, not only Danes, complain about taxes. But what we have to remember is that all the tax goes to improvement of the infrastructure.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials shed 10 points today, just one-tenth of 1%, closed at 10,441. The NASDAQ added 5 points, a quarter of 1%, finished at 2206. The S&P 500 picked up a point. That's a fraction percentage-wise, finished at 1109. Investors opened the window on Microsoft stock after the European Union dropped antitrust charges. Shares booted up nearly three-tenths of 1%. Here in the U.S., though, federal regulators filed a lawsuit against computer chip maker Intel on similar charges. The silicon ran out of the hourglass on the company's stock by 2%. Investors dropped into Walgreens after reports the drugstore chain hopes to use its supply of swine flu vaccine to get more customers in the door. Shares up 1% in that company today. MGM Mirage added 4,000 rooms to the already glutted hotel market in Las Vegas today, but investors decided not to take that bet. Shares closed basically flat. Overseas news that banks can ease into new capital requirements lifted markets in Europe. The German DAX and French CAC 40 both rose more than 1% today. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Bank of America, working to meet the capital needs of qualified businesses and consumers. Learn more at bankofamerica.com/ahead. And by Mars. For generations, Mars has been making real chocolate from 100% pure cocoa butter. More at MarsHealthyLiving.com. Why is a derivative like a Thanksgiving turkey? Visit the Marketplace whiteboard to find out. Our videos demystify the worlds of finance and economics. Just go to our website, marketplace.org.
On the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. In New York, the Conference Board releases its monthly index of leading economic indicators. Former Fed Chairman Alan Greenspan joins the Senate Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs Committee. The hearing examines securing our economic future. And it's the 20th anniversary of The Simpsons. The animated middle-class family entered our lives on December 17, 1989. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. For a good 3 hours on the floor of the United States Senate today, this was the sound of the healthcare debate.
Section 1514, payments for prescription drugs. A, establishment of list. One, in general. The board shall establish a list of approved prescription
Republicans used Senate rules to slow things down and force a page-by-page reading of a proposed amendment by Vermont independent Bernie Sanders. Sanders eventually gave up and pulled his 767-page amendment before it could be voted down. Among the amendments that actually have been voted down is one that would have let Americans import lower-cost prescription drugs from other countries. Seeing as how part of the original premise for a health care overhaul was to make things cheaper, we asked Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer what this decision is actually going to cost.
The Congressional Budget Office estimates the U.S. government could save almost $20 billion on its drug costs over the next 10 years if it could import prescription drugs. Other estimates say consumers would save $80 billion if they could buy their drugs from countries like Canada, where they're much cheaper. Larry McNeely is the healthcare advocate for the U.S. Public Interest Research Group.
You could see some drugs going for literally a fraction, a tenth of what they're charged here in the United States.
Vermont Senator Bernard Sanders says you can fill a Lipitor prescription in Canada for $33. In the U.S., the same prescription costs $125. But the Senate voted down an amendment to the health care overhaul that would have allowed the U.S. to import drugs approved by the FDA. McNeely says that's because of the lobbying muscle of the pharmaceutical industry.
Pharma is powerful enough to deny the success of a number of major pieces of legislation.
The drug industry has been generally supportive of a health care overhaul because it cut a deal with the Obama administration that it would give up no more than $80 billion in revenue over 10 years. Drug importation would have cost it billions more. White House critics say the industry got a sweetheart deal. But University of Michigan economist Eric Gordon says President Obama needs the drug company's support to get any kind of an overhaul at all.
I think what he is trying to do is come up with something that's workable.
Even if it doesn't get you Lipitor for $33. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Commentator Robert Reich points out that another time-tested way to cut costs in the healthcare system, competition, is strangely missing from the Senate debate.
The healthcare bill now moving perilously through the Senate still relies overwhelmingly on private for-profit insurers. They don't compete very much against one another and will have every incentive under the bill to compete even less. The bill gets rid of the public option and lets people who aren't covered by their employers buy into a system similar to the plan that federal employees now have. The federal government's Office of Personnel Management selects from among private insurers. But that's no answer. Premiums under the federal employee benefit plan increased nearly 9% this year, in part because of insufficient competition among the private insurers it depends on. According to data from the American Medical Association, only a handful of insurers dominate most states. In 9 states, 2 insurance companies control 85% or more of the market. In Arkansas alone, the Blue Cross plan controls almost 70% of the market. In light of all this, you'd think the Senate bill would at least subject the insurance industry to the antitrust laws. But no. Remarkably, the Senate bill still keeps big insurance safe from competition by preserving its privileged exemption from the antitrust laws. This makes no sense. Without a public option to compete against private insurers, and without antitrust laws to make sure they're competing against one another, insurers have every incentive to combine into a handful of giant companies that will suck every health dollar out of our pockets. If Americans are going to be required to get health insurance, health insurers have to be forced to compete, one way or the other.
Robert Reich is a professor of public policy at the University of California, Berkeley. Take a minute to share your thoughts, no matter where you work. Our website is marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. At this point in the UN Climate Conference, you might fairly be asking yourself this question. Why Copenhagen? I mean, it's nice enough, but mid-December is not the most visitor-friendly month to be in the Danish capital, after all. There is this to consider, though. With the pressure on to move to a clean, or at least a cleaner, economy, the Danes are miles ahead of almost everybody else in that regard. Marketplace's Sam Eaton reports now from Copenhagen.
One of the first things I noticed about Denmark is how easy it is to get around without ever using a car. Trains and subways go everywhere. Bike lanes are jammed with well-dressed professionals. And if you look closely at the horizon, you can see the spinning blades of offshore wind turbines.
I think we have a very good story to tell the world from a Danish perspective.
That's Finn Mortensen. He heads Climate Consortium Denmark, the country's clean tech trade group. He says today Denmark is one of the most energy-efficient nations in the world and a leader in clean technology exports. But the motivation to get there wasn't always about saving the planet.
If you turn back the time to late 1973, when we had the first oil crisis, Denmark was very severely affected. Prices went up, unemployment went up, the economy came to a standstill.
In a panic, the government slapped punishing taxes on anything that had to do with petroleum. Other countries did the same, but when oil prices dropped, Denmark kept its taxes in place, and it used the revenue to fund clean and efficient energy. Today, Denmark is one of the most heavily taxed countries in the world, but it also leads the world in wind power.
I don't know whether we are masochists in Denmark, but if you want to change attitudes, then it's not enough with the minuscule tax. You'll have to have a rather hefty tax. I mean, the price of gasoline in Denmark is three times as high to the consumer as it is in the U.S., for instance.
That's if you can even afford a car. The registration taxes on a new one actually cost more than the car's sticker price. Kasper Olesen, his wife Susanna, and their three-year-old are your typical suburban family here.
All people, not only Danes, complain about taxes. You look at it all, we got a lot of pluses in our tax system.
Like the bike trail Olesen uses to commute 10 miles to work every day. That's not to say the taxes are painless. Olesen's house, big by Danish standards, is about 1,600 square feet. When they moved in last August, the annual energy bill was more than $11,000 a year, an amount they couldn't possibly afford. But thanks to generous tax-funded rebates and a mortgage that rolls energy improvements into the total cost, they started making changes.
This is our old oil furnace. And we have changed it and today we use a state-of-the-art furnace for natural gases.
They've also added insulation, swapped out the windows, not only because they're concerned about their environmental impact, but because it makes financial sense. Most of their neighbors all up and down the street have done the same. And this points to one of the reasons the high taxes here haven't become a political liability.
Tax is not the answer as such. Tax has to be followed by the possibility to choose in other ways.
That's Steen Gada, chairman of the Environment Committee in the Danish Parliament. He says without major public investments in things like bike lanes, mass transit, and energy efficiency, the Danes probably would have revolted against high taxes. and businesses would have joined them if it weren't for the generous government help they get for becoming energy efficient and selling the products and services to do so.
Now business are asking us, the Greens, to fight for stronger regulation because then they see their economic benefits in the businesses.
But taxes and regulations do have limits. Danish farmers are often the fiercest critics of the country's punitive tax system. Vila Sorensen is a 10th-generation farmer here. He raises 7,500 pigs a year for export.
I use energy to transport my barley and my wheat and water, and I use energy to make the feed to the pigs and the ventilation.
Yeah, so big energy bill.
I use a lot of energy.
Sorensen's wife, Tina, says paying those bills has been a struggle, but they've managed to survive. She even sees the good in it. Their farm is now about as energy efficient as it can get, which makes it more competitive, at least in theory. And this is why she's following the Copenhagen climate talks so closely.
As it is now, we believe that it's possible in the future if there is the same rules for everybody. Mm. If we are the only country or the only farm who has to deal with it, then it'll be the competition will be too strong. But if the rules and the ideas are widespread, we believe that it's possible, yes.
She says Denmark's story is just the beginning. Now it's what the rest of the world does that really matters. In Copenhagen, I'm Sam Eaton for Marketplace.
All of our climate coverage, including past stories from Copenhagen and our special series, The Climate Race, is on our website. It's marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by Novo Nordisk, committed to changing diabetes through treatments, partnerships, and education. Defeating diabetes is our passion and our business. And by Putnam Investments, where a 529 plan can help meet your college savings goals. Details at putnam.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, two of them. Actually, the first we kind of gave you a heads up on yesterday. Time Magazine's Man of the Year and his colleagues at the Federal Open Market Committee have decided to keep interest rates steady at just about zero. Also, and we don't usually do obituaries, but Roy Disney died today. Walt's nephew is the main reason Michael Eisner is not running the Walt Disney Company anymore. Roy led a shareholder revolt that put Bob Iger in the top job 4 years ago. Roy Disney was 79. We are about, 21 years old? That's Marketplace from American Public Media this Wednesday afternoon. Today, the Dow lost 10 points. That's a 10th percent. The NASDAQ gained 5 points, a 0.25%. The S&P 500 ticked up a point. That is a fraction of 1%. Bahan Baladuni, Ravi Karman, Stephen Colon, Andrea Jackson-Gewirtz, Eric Johnson, Jeff Peters, and Charlton Thorpe engineered the program for us. Tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news and the latest from Copenhagen as well. And on this broadcast, an old print newspaper tries a new approach to daily news and to the classifieds.
I'm concerned about how I'm going to reach my customers if they're not reading AnnArbor.com. I don't know where I can go after that.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.